Welcome to Open Air, KLW's radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. It's a web-exclusive edition of Open Air, as our regular broadcast time is being preempted by the live coverage of the Senate impeachment trial of Donald J. Trump. I think you'd rather be listening to us, frankly, as I'll be talking with pianist Mona Golubek about her solo show, The Pianist of Willesden Lane, presented by TheaterWorks Silicon Valley at the Mountain View Center for the Performing Arts. The Pianist of Willesden Lane recounts the inspiring true story of Golubek's mother, Lisa Jura, a young Jewish musician. And it was created and directed by TheaterWorks' favorite, Hershey Felder, based on a book that Mona wrote. I'll also talk with Obie Award-winning playwright Will Eno about his new play, Wakey Wakey, starring two-time Emmy winner Tony Hale. That's at ACT. Plus, Open Air's regular contributor and critic at large, Peter Robinson, talks with Ruth Stein, founder of the Mostly British Film Festival, ahead of the festival's 12th anniversary edition coming up February 13th to the 20th here at the Vogue Theater in San Francisco. Stay with us. ACT kicks off the new year with Obie Award winner Will Eno's new play, Wakey Wakey. It's an intimate comedy drama that takes audiences on a theatrical journey that's surprising yet familiar. It stars two-time Emmy winner Tony Hale, who you may recognize from HBO's Veep and Fox Netflix Arrested Development. He was also the voice of Forky in Toy Story 4. It opens tonight at ACT and runs through February 16th. Playwright Will Eno is a Pulitzer finalist and Obie Award-winning theater maker. His play, The Open House, won a 2014 Obie Award, the Lucille Lortel Award for Outstanding Play, and a Drama Desk Award, and was one of Time Magazine's top 10 plays of the year. And I would love to have him back to talk about the book for the award-winning Skittles commercial, the Broadway musical. Maybe we'll have some time to talk about that later. Will, welcome to Open Air.
Hey, thanks very much for having me.
Okay. Well, this is an unconventional play that breaks down the fourth wall between audience and players. Director Ann Kaufman even calls it a great experiment.
I think it is. I hope it's a good experiment and a worthwhile experiment. And what I would, how I would define that is one that that works within the known truths of human experience, but also just seeks to arrive at them in a different way or something like that.
Okay, is it similar to your other works then, or is it completely a new territory for you?
It's maybe in a fun way, or fun for me anyway. It's a little, maybe it's halfway in between a couple of things. I think it's very much what it is, so it's not I don't think it's muddled, but I think it is it's pretty much a one-man show, but then it maybe becomes a one-man show where the one person needs some help from someone else to get through to the end of it.
Okay. The director, Ann Kaufman, who you've worked with before, has called you highly theatrical in your lack of theatricality. Give us an explanation of that.
Well, I guess if the theatrical is a good thing and the theatricality is a sort of, if that's a diss, then maybe that's what she means, that I hope I write things that are fundamentally theatrical, meaning that they are dynamic and that they achieve an effect in with a live audience, but they don't rely on all of the known conventions or the well-known conventions.
Okay.
If that's what Annie was saying. She goes by Annie. Even she, I've never asked her why she. It's Annie, though, but she spells it. Yes.
Okay. What I've been reading about the play, it's supposedly juxtaposing the profound with the ordinary, which you mentioned can sometimes be side by side.
You know, without going right for it, I really have. I've been thinking this a lot that I have this life, and you have this life. Here we are on Earth, and that, you know, people have written about it for thousands and thousands of years, and we can think about it in the grandest of terms, and we have these wishes and desires, and there's a bakery in Paris that I would love to take my daughter to one day, and all that, but this is sitting right here with you with that banner behind you and those DVDs twisting in the breeze over there. That this is really, really my life. You know, this is what it is, and this is what people were writing about for 10,000 years. And so I guess it's, I don't even know if they sit side by side. I think they're kind of folded into each other. The profound moments are, by definition, take place in the mundane run of seconds and minutes. You know?
Yeah, one of the concepts that you explore in Wakey Wakey is time, which can be your enemy or your friend. How different cultures approach time, how you experience time differently depending on your age, and importantly, how people's lives are forever different after certain moments in time.
I think that's another thing I was thinking about a lot in writing this is just, you know, that these things line up, these things that if you were to sit here and think, okay, what are the causes, what brought me to this moment right here, and I moved from Park, you were saying you lived in Park Slope and you got to here and then you did this and that. And so all these, there are these massive events, that the death of a parent or a tough relationship with a parent, and it all sort of lines up right. The sequence, you know, right next to the massive events are, oh, I missed a train, and so I had to walk to such, you know.
Are you looking at more at like a, almost like a these different points of being crossroads in your
right,
lives?
Right, mm. Right. And in terms of your life's journey, it doesn't really care whether it's a hugely profound event or it's just
only so many heartbeats you're going to get.
Right, exactly.
No matter what
you're doing. Yeah. But I mean, there's not a qualitative distinction between the profundity of the moment or the banality of the moment if it determines your direction. You know, you miss the bus, or your parent dies, or your child. My daughter being born was the best thing of my life, so I don't want to just throw that in there with missing a bus.
Okay. okay, let's get to the title, Wakey Wakey. What's that all about?
There is the notion of a wake, and I think this is partly, as an event, it might partly be a wake, and then also just the wakey wakey, eggs and bakey sort of thing of time to get up. And I guess that is similar to the thing we were talking about of the profound moments and the very time-based moments of, of waking up and also saying goodbye and celebrating and mourning and all those things.
Mm-hmm. The playwright Tony Kushner was infamous, if not notorious, for his constantly rewriting of his play Angels in America, even up to and after the dress rehearsals here in San Francisco. Now, is this play set in stone at this point, so to speak, or is it evolving?
It is not. I've definitely have done a good bit of fussing around, and it's really been incredible working with Tony Hale, who I've known his works so well from television, and I've only gotten to know him over the last 8 months or so. But just, it's a great thing to work with a different person and just see how words sit on them and how, you know, he brings a real self to the thing. And so I've definitely made some little adjustments here and there and some slightly bigger things. And also I wrote a short play to kind of precede Wakey Wakey for this ACT production that's all new.
Right. Okay. I'm just catching up myself with actor Tony Hale's work, especially on Arrested Development. I'm kind of binging that late at night, and I'm really behind on Veep. When did you first work with, well, you're just first working with him now, but what makes him so ideal for this role?
You know, he's just, when I think of those characters, Buster on Arrested Development and Gary on Veep, they're brave characters and they're noble characters. And I would not have thought that. Just, you know, he's so funny, but they're idiosyncratic people who really kind of stick by a very private code, I suppose, in these fairly obscene settings that both characters live in. And so I think the character Guy, who is in Wakey Wakey, is maybe a similarly idiosyncratic and kind of guided by a inner compass that might be different from other people's compass. And I also have to say about Tony, knowing those comic characters so well, he is just transformative in this thing. And he looks, I just can't get over what a sort of handsome and authoritative person he is. Uh-huh. And just, he's a really good guy. And it's just been a blast to work with him and Annie on this.
Well, he's expressed a little nervousness returning to the live stage, having been in the TV world for so long, where filming often happens out of sequence instead of start to finish. So how's he doing on stage?
He's doing great. And we had our very first, you know, we had an audience, a small dress rehearsal audience last night, and he did so well. It just was a beautiful, beautiful show. I hope he feels less nervous as the days go by. But that was a big leap to go from, you know, a kind of rehearsal room in daylight to suddenly you've got people you don't know who are sitting there wondering what's going to happen.
Sure. You know? Well, getting back to the actual words on paper, then, as far as the execution of your lines go and the play and the overall arc of the show. You've, of course, worked with Annie as the director, but are you hands-on in rehearsal as well, or is your beautiful bird set free to fly?
I'm either very involved with a thing or not, and it's best to not
interject.
It's best to not do it by half measures. So I've been very grateful to the amount that I was there for the first week of rehearsals and am back now, I really love talking with, working on things and being involved in the thing.
Given that the fourth wall with the audience is being broken, is there an improvisational element that's involved in the show then?
No, but then also that just by its nature there is. And I hope it feels, there was someone asked last night how much of it was written. And the answer was, well, every word of it, in fact. But
okay.
I thought that was a great, great response, mm-hmm. and a great, that was high marks for Tony, that it just feels very, very live. And of course, that's the beautiful thing is, you know, you're going to have phones going off and sirens and all sorts of things that happen in the actual world, since this is the actual world.
Right, right. Well, we should also talk about the companion play that is presented as part of the evening, The Substitution, that features ACT MFA program actors that are also in the cast of Wakey Wakey.
They are not, in fact. It's just the cast is just Catherine and Tony for Wakey Wakey, and then this play has four MFA students and Catherine, who's also in Wakey Wakey, which was great. That was something Pam McKinnon at ACT asked if I wanted to write something, just a short play to kick off the evening that might include some of the students, just because I think ACT is really wonderful in that respect, that it has, you know, it is sort of the old model of kind of the way English actors would learn to act, where they were kind of sweeping up around the theater and then...
Almost like a repertory theater.
Kind of, yeah, right, yes, exactly. Yeah.
Let's put on a show kind of thing.
Yeah.
Well, I wish you a splendid run of Wakey Wakey at ACT with that splendid cast featuring Tony Hale. There are a number of companion events that are associated with ACT's productions, as always. Tonight's Bike to the Theater work, where the good folks from the San Francisco Bicycle Coalition will offer free valet parking. Drinks and Drama Friday, a new pre-show evening of specialty cocktails, along with some pop-up food and a DJ, as well as several other events, which include Theater on the Couch for a more psychological approach of talking about the show, as well as Pride Night, formerly Out with ACT. That'll be Wednesday, February 5th. Before and following the 7:30 performance, also a wine night. You can learn about all of this at act-sf.org. It's through the 16th of February at the Geary Theater. Thanks so much for coming in, Will. We'll look forward to the show.
Great. Thanks a lot.
Still to come, Peter Robinson will be on hand to talk with Ruthie Stein about the Mostly British Film Festival. And next, a nice musical encounter with my next guest, Mona Golubek. Music of Claude Debussy, Clair de Lune, which will be heard as part of TheatreWorks Silicon Valley's production of The Pianist of Willesden Lane. And due to popular demand, the theater will extend the run of this internationally acclaimed work through February 16th. It's starring celebrated pianist Mona Golubek in a triumphant tour de force which recounts the inspiring true story of Mona's mother, Lisa Jura, a young Jewish musician, and follows Jura's escape from Nazi-occupied Austria via the Kindertransport and her life in a children's home on Willesden Lane in London, where she later survived the London Blitz. Combining vivid storytelling and a masterful performance of classics by Bach, Beethoven, and Rachmaninoff, this is a one-woman show that shows and illustrates how music can bring light and hope to even the darkest of times. It was directed and adapted by the great Hershey Felder, actor, pianist, writer, composer, conductor, producer, who has conjured the spirits of George Gershwin, Frederick Chopin, Beethoven, Liszt, Leonard Bernstein, Tchaikovsky, Claude Debussy, and Irving Berlin, and has been a frequent guest here on Open Air. My guest in studio is pianist Mona Golubek, who is an internationally renowned concert pianist, actor, author, and radio host. She's the subject of several documentaries, including More Than Music and A Concert for Mona. She's a Grammy nominee, has performed concerts across the globe, and is founder and president of the nonprofit Hold On to Your Music, and the host of a classical music radio show in her own right, The Romantic Hours, which blends classical music with readings of love letters and poetry. Mona, it almost seems as if we should have you as your own host for this segment. Tell me first a little bit about the radio show that you do. It sounds really lovely.
Well, when I was a kid and my mom taught me the piano, she always said that each piece of music tells a story. And in between the Bach and the Beethoven, she told me the story of her life. But she also told me about Robert and Clara Schumann and Brahms and the great love stories behind many of the composers. I don't know what got a hold of me, but many years later, I was brought to a radio station. We were promoting a recording that I had done. And when the interview was over, the wonderful person that was interviewing me said, "So what are your fantasies?" And I said, "I'd love to maybe do a radio show where I could speak about the great composers and some of their journals and combine it with classical music," and sort of led to a syndicated show called The Romantic Hours, where we combine poetry and journals and, you know, put Chinese poets with Messiaen or Bach with Browning. I mean, crazy stuff that we did, and it's been a wonderful experience to do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is quite a story. How old were you when you first learned of your mother's incredible journey?
I probably was around 7 or 8 years old when she first started to tell me the story in the piano lessons. as I said, between the Bach and the Beethoven. She also told it to me at nighttime when she put me to sleep. So it kind of found its way into my heart. I've often said that she, in a way, I hate to use that word, but she branded my heart in many ways with these stories. She probably branded my heart with the 6 million numbers. I didn't even realize it at the time. And then push ahead a couple of decades, and I was engaged to play the Grieg Piano Concerto myself, that she had dreamed about making her debut in the Musikverein as a young girl in Vienna, when she would always go on the trolley to her piano lessons. And I started to remember those stories. It all flooded back. And I thought, wow, that's the piece she always told me about. I don't know what got a hold of me, but I decided if I could get something out there, if I could research it, if I could put it down in a book, if I could maybe get a film made or a play somehow, I could inspire readers and people that would come maybe to a show and to the powerful messages in my mother's story. In her particular case, it was about how music saved her and gave her the strength to face an uncertain future. But it's really a much bigger story and message. It's really about man's humanity to man, because that generation made a decision in England, British Jews and Christians coming together to save the lives of 10,000 refugee children.
Right. And you articulated this in a book you wrote with Lee Cohen called The Children of Willesden Lane.
Yes.
And how did it come to the attention of the great Hershey Felder, a good friend?
He is absolutely incomparable. He changed my world. He has afforded me the opportunity to bring this story to the world. How it happened was that I was brought to see his Beethoven show at the Geffen Playhouse. This might have been in 2008 or 2009. I was so stunned. I walked out mesmerized. So I somehow had his phone number. Someone gave it to me. I picked it up. I called him. I was really seeking advice. How could I take that story? Because a lot of people had thought it might translate very well to the stage. And he was very gracious. He's very, very generous to fellow artists. He invited me to come to the Geffen Playhouse. He put me on the stage. The hall was completely empty. He was there in the audience. I remember, I'm fond of saying that I did a sort of a 30-minute presentation for him, sort of a prototype, told him the story, played some of the music. I kept looking out of the corner of my eye to look at him every so often, and I thought, I think he's bored, or maybe he's asleep. I wasn't quite sure what was going on. But when it was over, I looked over at him. There was silence for a couple of seconds. I thought, I don't think this went very well. Mm-hmm. And then he looked at me and said, that is a very moving story, and I'm going to produce you. Well, I was shocked.
Wow, fantastic.
So shocked. I had no idea. I didn't even really know what I was going to face here. But he's an extraordinary artist, exacting, deeply disciplined, highest standards, and he was extraordinarily tough on me. I followed him around for about 2 years in different places where he was doing the show in Chicago, and I went to Paris. We would keep working back and forth. And then he gave me a shot at an audition at the Geffen Playhouse in the Black Box.
Nice, nice. Hershey's shows are sort of characteristic of him inhabiting multiple characters. Is this true of you in The Pianist of Willesden Lane?
Yes. He challenged me to go to a wig store, buy a red wig, and put it on. And I thought he was crazy, but I did it. We tried on a bunch of wigs. And then he said, you're going to become your mother. I'm going to change all of this, and you're going to do this in first person. Because as I had mentioned previously, I had been doing a prototype in third person for students and, you know, sort of select occasions here and there when the book came out. And then as he wrote the script, I was to inhabit the characters that my mother met along the way. Her teacher, who couldn't teach her any longer. The kind man that ran the refugee organization in London called the Bloomsbury House. Mrs. Cohen, the German Jew, more German than Jewish, who was shocked to be responsible for 30 Jewish refugee kids that had come out on the kinder transport. Aaron, the boy that she was sweet on. Mabel Floyd, the teacher that would eventually give her the scholarship to work with her. I had to learn how to inhabit those characters. And my lucky day was also when it crossed with an extraordinary acting coach by the name of Howard Fine. And he himself had family that had come out of the Holocaust. So he was very sensitive to this, and he took me under his wings to try to teach me, how do you inhabit those characters? How do you live this life alive on stage every night?
Well, how traumatic it must have been for this little girl, your mother, to be displaced by the war and then to be bombarded in the London Blitz. Truly is a story of hope and survival.
I've often thought, what did my mother feel when the train was pulling away from the Vienna Westbahnhof train station? Lately, I find myself wondering, what was my grandmother feeling as she looked at the train taking her daughter away?
I was going to ask, were a lot of the family annihilated in the war, or what happened?
Most of these kids that were rescued
I'm
and brought
your
over.
The family of your mother's mother.
Yes. I tend not to give away the story because obviously I want people to come to experience it. So the entire play, or a great part of it, is wondering, did they survive? And it's revealed at the end when my mother fulfills the dream that was cut short for her when she walks out on stage and makes her debut in the Grieg Piano Concerto, but she does it in London instead of Vienna. And for me, what has been really the greatest honor is that I've had the opportunity to bring this story now to not only across America through the production, but also through the educational mission. And then 2 years ago, the Austrian government brought me back to Vienna when the German edition of the book came out. And I made my debut in the Musikverein, the place that my mother had dreamed about.
Wow, that's lovely. That's lovely. So tell us, so some of these stories are why you selected the music you did. Tell us more about the selections.
The music drives the narrative. They're very carefully chosen. It relates back again to that statement that my mother made, each piece of music tells a story. So when you listen to the Clair de Lune of Debussy, you imagine what my mother must have felt when she saw the moonlight coming through the turning of the windmills, when the train went through Holland. When you're in the old studio of the professor who can no longer teach her, and you're hearing the Moonlight Sonata of Beethoven, that seriousness, you feel an old world that you're going to lose. When my mother goes down into the basement of the hostel, when the Blitz is in full force, determined not to let go of her music, and pounds out the cadenza of the Grieg Piano Concerto, those ferocious chords, you feel her defiance, that nothing will come between her and the music. She's going to go one-on-one against Hitler. And then my favorite moment practically in the entire play, the Rachmaninoff Prelude in C-sharp minor, one of the most famous pieces, da, da, da. When those chords come out and I'm pounding them on the stage, and projected onto the stage are the images of D-Day and the Allies coming from brave men from all walks of life, giving their lives. And you see the image of the cemeteries there, of all these beautiful young men who sacrifice so that we can walk in freedom. You feel those chords of the Rachmaninoff as you look at these images. So he carefully chose everything, Hershey, when we would talk it out. What music will really drive the narrative and the drama?
This is, of course, aligning with the 75th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz-Birkenau and the United Nations designated International Holocaust Remembrance Day on January 27th to remember the 6 million Jewish victims and millions of other victims of the Holocaust, and to help prevent future genocides. You must also be aware of the Violins of Hope collection that's been making the circulation. We had guests
Absolutely. On
last week. It's so wonderful to have this. And they're calling it Violins of Hope for a reason. These were instruments that were found or donated through victims of the Holocaust, but it's still a hopeful message that's behind that, as is this.
Yes. And my grandmother told my mother at the train station, I want you to promise me that you're going to hold on to your music no matter what happens, and I will be with you through the music always, in every note and every phrase. And recently I came from South Africa, where 10,000 children experienced a form of the show and had read the book. And it was so incredible to see these young African learners respond to a message about a Jewish teenager in World War II that has more relevance today than ever before. When we look at the dialogue in the world, the divisiveness that's happening, to see young people cheer this story and know that it speaks to them has just given me an incredible sense of purpose with this work.
Mm. We should also mention that TheaterWorks Silicon Valley has announced a special post-show forum with Mona and Helga Newman, a real-life Kinder Transport refugee who currently resides in Palo Alto, following the 2 p.m. performance of The Pianist of Willesden Lane on Saturday, February 1st at the Mountain View Center for the Performing Arts. Mona and Ms. Newman will take the stage for a one-time-only discussion moderated by Lisa Edsall Giglio, TheaterWorks Director of Education. It's a free forum open to audience members and community members as well. Mona, I wish you a fantastic journey down in TheaterWorks Silicon Valley. Congratulations on the extension as well. And I look forward to catching your show. And let's have folks imagine the D-Day slides that you will see as part of The Pianist of Willesden Lane. And this is Mona playing some Rachmaninoff. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you. It was an honor.
Music of Rachmaninoff as performed by Mona Golubek and as part of The Pianist of Willesden Lane in London. That show being presented by TheaterWorks Silicon Valley. TheaterWorks.org for more information. A very good afternoon to you. I'm David LaTulipe here usually on the air at 1 p.m. on KALW for our Thursday presentation of Open Air. But Donald John Trump is being tried now in the Senate, and we're carrying live Senate hearings as part of our community service here on KALW. So this is the special web edition only of Open Air. Pleased to welcome back Peter Robinson and his guest, Ruth Stein, to talk about the Mostly British Film Festival.
Hi, Ruth. Welcome to KALW. And also, congratulations, 12 years of the Mostly British Film Festival. Quite an achievement. And this is a city of moviegoers, certainly a city of movie festivals. But I think the unique thing about the Mostly British Film Festival, and just looking at this year, is that we have 26 different countries represented.
Not 26 countries, but 26 films.
26 films.
Films from the Great Britain, Australia, South Africa, India, and Australia. So just five countries, 26.
Five countries with 26 films. And I think just for people interested in how the English speak and how the Australians speak and how the New Zealanders speak, how in India and Ireland, it's a conglomeration of wonderful accents. But also, when you're putting on a movie festival, and I know you've been doing this, you kind of think of the different cultures each of these different countries bring. And I noticed we're starting off with a movie called Military Wives. So do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, every year we go through this, myself and the other programmers who work on the festival, because selecting an opening night film is really special. I mean, we like to think all of our films are special, but opening night sort of sets a tone for what the festival is going to be. And I'm not sure that I can really describe what makes an opening night film, but I know when I see one.
Right.
And about 20 minutes into this wonderful film called Military Wives, I said, we've got to have this for opening night. It's directed by Peter Cantonito, who it was the director of the Full Monty. I'm sure a lot of your listeners out there remember that one. And Military Wives has that same wonderful sense of humor about it, but with an underpinning of drama when you think about this is about the wives of men who are stationed in Afghanistan, and they really don't have much to do with their time, so they decide they want to put together a choral group. So it has that underpinning of they're all worried about their husbands. Are their husbands going to get through this alive? Are they going to be injured? And this is meant to be a diversion. The wonderful Kristen Scott Thomas plays the wife of a general, and she's very posh, and she has very definite opinions about what the choir ought to sound like. And the women in the group sometimes set her straight that may be not what they're going to do. But it's really a film that I think will touch our listeners, and I feel that way actually about almost all of the films in the festival this year. They all have some kind of an emotional pull, which is really important for me in watching a movie. There has to be something that grips me and makes me care about the characters and makes me get kind of lost in their world.
And I think with the Military Wives, it's a very timely topic because Afghanistan is in the news. Will we pull out? Will we stay there?
Well, I didn't.
And
we didn't know
what happens to the women who are supporting the troops? I think that's one of the key questions.
Yeah, it is. What happens to them in the kind of seesaw of the existence of their lives, really, because they don't really know what's going to be happening. And just as important as picking an opening night film is picking a closing night film. And our closing night film is more of a comedy, I would say a black comedy, an extremely funny movie starring the great Steve Coogan, who just last year played Stan in that film Stan and Laurel. In this movie, he's a disgustingly rich London fashion mogul called Sir Richard MacCready, and his friends call him Greedy. He decides to throw himself an ostentatious, Romanesque, 60th birthday party on the island of Mykonos. So he's sort of confusing his Greeks and his Romans there. And what happens in this party in which Steve Coogan looks hysterical in a Roman toga? The underplaying of it, I think, will very much amuse our audiences.
Yeah, so those are the good bookends. Now, between, we've got some exciting ones. I was looking at a comedy called Say My Name.
Yes, I'm glad you mentioned that one because we're very fortunate to have both the star, Lisa Brenner, and the director, Jay Stern, coming to the screening of that film, which will be on Valentine's Day. It's part of our triple romantic feature for February 14th. And in Say My Name, it's sort of a screwball comedy and the kind you expect Katherine Hepburn to pop up at any moment. Really fast-paced rom-com in which these two people meet at a bar. They decide they're going to have a one-night stand, and in the middle of it, they get robbed. And the burglars bring them into sort of their own world, and we start to discover things about this couple that we might have been very surprised to know at the beginning. She's really confident and clever, him not so much. And it's quite charming, and we're following it up with a film.
That's right. Just hold on. I think Diane Keaton is involved.
Well, no, this is the next film that I just going to talk about. Okay. So our next film is Hampstead. It's playing at 7:30 on Valentine's Day. And this is a film that I've been after for 3 years. It's one of Harvey Weinstein's orphans because it was a film that was all set to play when he got into really trouble. And his films were sort of bounced around from one distributor to another. And I've been trying to get them literally for 3 years. And finally, it found its way home to a distributor that I've worked with in the past. And we got the film. And it's one of the things I love about this festival is I love showing the parts of the world that these films are played out in as well. As you know, having these great dramatic stories to tell. And this is set in Hampstead, which anyone who's been to London knows about Hampstead and walking on Hampstead Heath. And Diane Keaton plays an American who's been living there. Her husband dies, leaving her penniless, which she had no idea about. And Brendan Gleeson, he's even further down the ladder. He's an Irish squatter living in a rancid shed. Well, the community wants to get rid of him, and she reaches out to try to help him, and in the process, they fall in love. And it's an unlikely couple, but they are quite magical together.
I should add that all this is taking place at the Vogue Theatre,
yes,
which is one of the other great classic theatres here on Sacramento Street.
The oldest theatre in San Francisco. There may be other theatres claiming that, but we think ours is. And just to quickly end with our Valentine's Day romances, we then have a film called Only You, which is about a couple who meet and they get married and then they end up having some problems in the relationship. So the trio of the films works really well. If you're one of these people who can exist on popcorn and water, I suggest you show up on Valentine's Day and watch all three.
Now, I've got to say, there is a feeling of what I call the Me Too movement surfacing here. And I'm thinking of one particular movie. It's called Ophelia, which I think is really interesting because it shows the Hamlet play, but this time from the female perspective. And with Daisy Ridley, who people may know from Star Wars, she is the Ophelia, and even Clive Owens gets to look in as the uncle.
So the evil uncle.
The evil uncle. So if you're familiar with the Get Thee to a Nunnery and the whole role of how dismissive, you know, Hamlet is of Ophelia, now she has a voice for herself.
And let's not forget Hamlet's mother is played by Naomi Watts. So it's an all-star cast directed by a young woman, very promising director. We have several films in the festival that are directed by women, which we're really pleased about. We didn't select them because they were directed by women, but it happened that women have made some really fine films this year. And this is one of them, and I think it has really, really terrific production values. And I think for anyone who knows Shakespeare and knows Hamlet, they'll find this a very interesting twist on an old story.
Now, the website for the Mostly British Film Festival, do you want to give that out?
I certainly will. You remember when Jerry Brown, during his campaign, was always giving his website, and people thought he was nuts, and now everybody does it. So we are mostlybritish.org. It's just as simple as that.
Okay. Now, the Irish get a look in.
Yes.
And this, I thought, was a really interesting clip I watched called The Man Who Wanted to Fly. Very much the story of a man who, I think he's almost aged 80 when he finally leaves the ground.
Yeah.
And it's a kind of cross between a documentary and a biofilm. And it kind of captures someone wanting to fulfill a lifelong desire.
This gentleman, Bobby, has spent his career fixing clocks and making violins out of old furniture. But his dream has always been to fly. And I don't want to give away the ending of this, but the whole film is about if he's going to be able to do it or not. And he is a total charmer, Bobby Coote. And it is, as you mentioned, a documentary, one of several excellent documentaries that we're showing at the festival. Another one I might just make a quick plug for is Jill Bilcock, Dancing the Invisible, who is an Australian film editor, and among her credits is Moulin Rouge, Muriel's Wedding, Romeo and Juliet, Strictly Ballroom, and The Young Victoria. And this film is filled with clips from her films and also interviews with renowned directors and actors. And she's very charming and has really wonderful stories to tell about filmmaking in Australia. I believe we have five documentaries, and they're always really good and really popular.
So if you're looking for a cornucopia of movies literally from around the world, from India, from South Africa, from Ireland, from Australia, and let's not forget the UK since I'm sitting here about
it's mostly British.
Mostly British, and that's where the title comes from, the Mostly British Film Festival. And what is the website again?
Mostlybritish.org.
Mostly British. There you are. You can't go wrong with that. And these events are all taking place at the Vogue Theatre, one of the great classic theatres here in San Francisco. And the dates that things run from?
Yes, it runs from February 13th to the 20th. And I might add that Peter Robinson is on our board and is a really wonderful member of our board. We have honest-to-goodness Brits, honest-to-goodness Australians on our board. And I always have them make the phone calls to these various studios in Ireland and England because they sound authentic. And I'm like, what is this American woman doing calling up about our films? We sometimes call this a film festival for people who don't want to read subtitles.
Well, there we go. So again, thank you, Ruth, for coming in.
Thank you for inviting me.
And a great festival, and it begins on February the 13th at the Vogue Theatre.
Thank you, Ruth Stein and Peter Robinson, for your contributions this week on Open Air. MostlyBritish.org for all things on the Mostly British Film Festival. A very good afternoon. If you're listening in the afternoon, perhaps you're listening on the evening because this is a special web-only edition of Open Air due to our trial coverage and from NPR in Washington of our senators trying Donald John Trump. Thanks to Neil Swinkels for producing the show. You're listening online at klw.org. I'm David at klw.org. And next week on Open Air, I'll be talking with music director Donato Cabrera about the All Brahms concerts that are planned with the California Symphony. I'll talk with founder and curator Brian Rosen about Snapshot, new works of opera in an informal setting by West Edge Opera together with Earplay New Chamber Music Ensemble. Also, I'll have 18 melodies for Hujia with music and text translation by Juan Huang, who is with a score that echoes the ancient Chinese wind instrument and the title El Changuru, with music by Peter Michael von Nehmer and libretto by Cynthia Lewis Farrell. That's next week on Open Air here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco. Thanks for being with us.